Engineering. Arturo looked at him and said, There are many types of engineers. I did a double major in aeronautical engineering and industrial engineering. I also got minor degrees in English literature and military history. The elder gentleman looked impressed.
Engineering, engineering, excellent. I am surprised that so many other young people waste their time in other trifling fields. He again looked at Ian intently and asked, That much work must have been difficult. How were your grades?
Ian smiled. It was a lot of work, but I enjoyed the material. I graduated cum laude. Arturo stood up, smiled slightly while nodding his head, and said,
Very good. Very, very good.
With a wave of his hand, the maid brought iced tea, and they sipped it as they watched Ian's videotape. Doyle introduced it by just saying, These clips you'll see were all shot by me from the back seat of a D-model F-16. That's the version with two seats. The first clip showed some tight formation flying. The second showed takeoffs, landings, and touch-and-goes. Just before the third segment, Ian voiced the caveat, Now, this part coming up, it wasn't me at the controls, and I had no warning that my friend was going to do this. I was just along for the ride and to preserve the events for posterity. The video then showed the plane doing slow rolls high over San Francisco, passing through patchy clouds, and then diving to line up west of the city. It then flew under the Golden Gate Bridge and then under the San Francisco Bay Bridge, with the pilot twice exclaiming, Yee-haw! Both of the Araneta's gasped and laughed. Ian then commented, I found out later that Fred had the crew chief disable the plane's transponder so there'd be no comebacks. Arturo chuckled and said,
Very clever, and I'm glad this was not you flying so illegally.
The last segment of the video was several minutes of aerobatics shot over the pilot's shoulder. In one corner of the screen, the plane's altimeter could be seen winding down from 30,000 feet at an alarming rate. The significance of some of the maneuvers was lost on her father, but Blanca was clearly impressed. She kept saying,
Wow! And double wow!
As Ian disconnected his camcorder, Arturo exclaimed,
That was fantastic! Simply fantastic!
Next, the subject of tennis came up, as Blanca had warned it always did with her father. He started by saying,
You know, seeing San Francisco in that videotape reminds me.
He spent the next half hour in an animated description of how he had toured the United States playing tennis tournaments in the 1980s, and how he had learned to disco dance. He ended by mentioning,
You know, when I was there, I became so fascinated with your basketball. Other than tennis, that is now the sport I watch the most on the satellite television.
Really? Ian asked. What is your favorite American team? The Honduran replied,
Oh, the Detroit Pistons, most definitely.
Ian laughed. Did Blanca mention that I was raised near Detroit? Arturo Araneta put on a huge grin. Ian put in hesitantly, Although, I've got to say I'm just as much a Lakers fan as I am a fan of the Pistons.
The Lakers, they are a fine team, too, but sometimes, with all their physicality, they lack the, finesse and control of the Pistons.
Just when Doyle thought that he could not have hit it off more perfectly, Arturo asked,
So, what does a fighter jockey like you do for hobbies?
I like to run, swim, and I do a lot of target shooting.
Araneta chortled.
You're a shooter.
Come with me, my boy, and I will show you my modest gun collection. As the three of them walked together toward the other wing of the house,
Blanca laughed and whispered, "The long-lost son returns."
As they walked, Ian glanced over his shoulder and noticed the maid following 5 paces back, dutifully carrying a tray with their drinks. He realized that this sort of life would take some getting used to. They spent the next half hour chit-chatting and admiring guns pulled out of a climate-controlled walk-in vault. Araneta had a huge collection of perhaps 200 guns and 50 swords and sabers. Sitting on a large wooden stand in the center of the vault room was an exquisitely ornamented saddle with a saber and a pair of holstered horse pistols. The saddle was clearly the centerpiece of his collection. Arturo explained, "This saddle belonged to a lieutenant of Simón Bolívar. I bought it by private treaty from a collector before it could go to auction." Doyle noted that Arturo's collection was eclectic, ranging from a 16th-century Chinese hand cannon to one of the latest Colt Anaconda revolvers. But the collection mostly emphasized muzzleloaders and horse pistols, representing 400 years of development for the latter. In deference to the humid climate in Honduras, they all wore white cotton gloves as they handled the guns. As they were examining his modern guns, Araneta asked, "What do you think of Blanca's Glock 19?
"You have a Glock?" Ian asked Blanca, surprised.
Blanca answered with a slight tone of condescension,
"Yes, of course, the one I carry every day in my flight bag. It's got night sights on it. I'm a very good shot."
"I had no idea that you packed."
Blanca laughed and said,
"You Yankees have no idea how many Hondurans carry guns every day of the week. We just make no big deal about it. Daddy bought me the Glock and also the Mercedes. The car is intentionally old and ugly on the outside, but it has a brand new engine and transmission. Actually, the rust spots on the door panels are not really rust. They are just painted on. It's the perfecto anti-kidnapping car. Not like anything anyone would expect me to drive. Even so, it is built like a tank and could knock most other cars off the road."
Ian stroked his chin and said,
"The more I learn about you, Senorita, the more there is to like about you. You're the complete package. She flies, she swims, she shoots, she dresses tastefully, she drives a stealth tank, she likes flamenco guitar."
"You left out that I'm a great cook and an excellent dancer."
All three of them laughed. Finally, they sat down to a 4-course dinner that was served by the cook and dutifully attended by the maid. The conversation over dinner ranged from flying to shooting to duck hunting to Arturo's recollections of what Blanca was like as a little girl and, of course, to tennis. Ian got to try out some of his new Spanish phrases. His fractured grammar and conjugational follow-ups earned him a lot of good-spirited laughter. Arturo was gracious, saying only,
"You are learning quickly, my boy, and I'm glad to hear you use a good Castilian accent. So many Americans I meet, even scientists and engineers, are educated only in the gutter Spanish."
After a long pause, Arturo glanced over the top of his glasses and asked gravely,
"Are you Catholic?"
"Yes, sir. Born and raised Irish Catholic. I still attend Mass faithfully."
Realizing that he was taking a huge risk of offending his host, he added,
"But additionally, I have come to more of a personal faith in Jesus Christ. Between him and me, I feel no need of a mediator. The Pope and the priests are fine for ceremony, but I truly feel that I'm saved personally, by Jesus, by faith in him alone, by his grace, and with my sins paid for by his sacrifice on the cross. I love Jesus with all mi corazón."
Arturo brightened and clasped his hand on Ian's shoulder.
I feel the same way also. It is refreshing to hear that from a fellow member of the church.
Everything continued to go well until it was time for cigars and brandy. Arturo was slightly miffed when Ian accepted a snifter, but refused a cigar, saying,
Lo siento mucho, señor, but I don't smoke. Yo no fumo.
As he trimmed and lit his cigar, Arturo tut-tutted and then said resignedly,
Oh, well, you pilots are such health nuts. You don't know what you're missing.
Ah, Honduran cigars are just as good as Los Cubanos. But I can say I now smoke only about one of these a month.
Blanca joked,
You know, Daddy, I gave up cigars years ago when I decided to follow in the steps of Amelia Earhart.
As Blanca gave Ian a ride back to the base, she went on and on about how well Ian had gotten along with her father, mentioning how unprecedented that was. After a couple of minutes of driving on in silence, she said simply,
I think he really likes you, Ian.
I like him, too.
Then he asked,
Where'd you get that pearl necklace? Before they were married, my father and mother went on a trip to Islas de la Bahia. Those are our bay islands on the east coast. They were snorkeling, and Daddy dove to bring up an oyster. Inside of this oyster was this pearl. Later on that same day, my father asked my mother to marry him. The pearl, it was too big and fragile for a ring, so it was placed on this necklace. Ever since then, my father nicknamed my mother Conchita, which means little oyster. And now, he sometimes calls me that.
After a long pause, she added,
My mother gave me this when she was dying of the cancer.
Lo siento mucho, Blanca.
It's okay. That was a long time ago.
May I call you Conchita?
Blanca giggled.
Yes, Ian, you may, but not in public. You see, among the lower classes, especially in Argentina, Conchita has a different, very crude meaning. So please, don't you call me that around other people, or at least around anyone from Argentina.
Si, mi Conchita.
She drove on in silence, obviously deep in thought. After passing through the formalities with the airbase's gate guards, Blanca turned to face Ian and said,
You know, Mr. Lieutenant Doyle, you were very clever finding out all those things about me from Consuelo.
Yes, I must admit I do overplan things.
So, why did you do all that? The orchids and the almond roca? I think also the flamenco music?
Her voice grew sharp.
Why?
Doyle coughed nervously.
Because I fell in love with your voice on the radio from the tower, even before I ever laid eyes on you. And when someone like me loves someone as much as I love you, well, I'm the kind of guy that will nearly warp space and time just to make everything fall into place.
I am absolutely head over heels crazy in love with you, Blanca.
Just then, her car reached the driving circle in front of the White House.
Perhaps I will see you again, Ian,
she said, ushering him out with a wave and a smile. He blew her a kiss. As her eyes lingered on him for a moment, he added, half shouting,
Encantado, señorita.
As he approached the front steps of the White House, Ian Doyle stopped in his tracks. He realized why Blanca had worn the pearl necklace. That pearl had been a key part of her father's marriage proposal to her mother. Wearing it had been her way of telling her father
This man is bona fide marriage material.
The next few weeks were a blur. The squadron's operational tempo increased, and Ian was flying a lot. Most of his contact with Blanca was by correspondence. Their love letters began cordially, but became more familiar and gained a note of passion as time went on. Partly because two of the Hondo expedition pilots had fallen ill with traveler's tummy, Ian was flying as much as 6 days a week, a grueling pace. Most of Ian's missions were uneventful. The only real excitement came on a couple flights when his plane's radar warning receiver went off over hostile territory. These were mainly gun-dish radars, part of Russian-built ZSU-23-4s, four-barrel, 23-millimeter anti-aircraft cannons. The plane's radar warning receiver, RWR, going off, caused a bit of angst and prompted some lively discussion at the post-flight debriefings. On a Sunday, 40 days into his Honduras rotation, Blanca took Ian flying. Above his objection to split the cost, she treated him to a 2-hour rental in her favorite plane, an Italian-built Pioneer P-200. It was a very small, sleek, low-wing plane that had unusual dual sticks in a side-by-side cockpit. As they approached the plane for their pre-flight, Doyle said, "I was expecting you to rent some zippy biplane with seats fore and aft." She grinned.
"I think a side-by-side configuration like this is much more, romantica, no?"
Quickly changing subjects, she said,
"The dry weight of this bird is only 260 kilos, light as a feather."
"Oh, man, that is light. Did you know that an F-16 weighs about 12,000 kilos, fully fueled?"
Blanca was wearing a very attractive white flight suit with zippers everywhere. As they walked around the plane, checking the fuel tanks, wiggling the wings, and checking the flaps and rudder, Doyle's eyes kept drifting back to Blanca. The flight suit certainly accentuated her trim figure. They pulled the chocks and climbed aboard. Sitting in the plane's left seat, he admired Blanca's finesse as she worked the radio and rolled out to the taxi strip, craning her head to do repeated 360 eyeballs of both the plane's control surfaces and her surroundings. She didn't miss a beat. After getting takeoff clearance, she punched in the throttle and took off after a surprisingly short roll. Climbing out at 700 feet per minute, she took the plane up to 10,000 feet and headed west as they chatted about the plane's characteristics.
"What's this bird stressed for?" Ian asked.
"4 G's plus and 2 G's negative."
Doyle nodded approvingly. Blanca continued.
"It's been upgraded to a 110-horsepower plant. She'll do 145 miles per hour at altitude. Red line is 5,600 RPMs. Oh, and watch your sink rate if you pull more than a 60 degrees bank. I think you'll like flying it. It takes very light control forces. I love this plane because you don't have to muscle the stick."
Glancing at the GPS, she declared,
"Okay, hombre, now we are outside of the TCA, and we can play."
Banking sharply left and right to get a view under the plane's wings and swiveling her head, she said,
"I see empty skies."
Doyle echoed,
"Ditto. I confirm I see no traffic. Let's play."
Blanca snugged the straps on her X-harness and, with no cue needed, Doyle did likewise. Blanca then immediately launched into a series of aerobatics that would have made most other passengers puke. Doyle was whooping and laughing. She burned through 7,000 feet in less than a minute, doing rolls, loops, and spins. At one point, Blanca's flight bag levitated to the ceiling as they pulled negative G's. Doyle snatched it and tucked it under his arm. After climbing back up to 10,000 feet, Blanca put on a devilish grin. She launched into another series of maneuvers, even more violent. At one point, Ian's vision narrowed from the effect of pulling 3 Gs. Doyle never once felt tempted to take the controls, even when she intentionally put the plane into a flat spin. She deftly recovered, and they both laughed. She climbed once again and put the plane through a pair of Immelmann turns and then a neat 4-point roll.
"Now, you show me something," she said, making a show of throwing her hands up off the stick.
Quickly drying his palms on his pant legs, Doyle grasped the other stick. He then took a couple of tentative turns, getting a feel for the aircraft. He throttled the engine up slightly and then adjusted the trim wheel to counteract the propeller's torque. This took a couple of tries to get just right, since he was unfamiliar with the gradation of the wheel.
"Valet, you just showed me a very nice 4-point roll. Now, this is an 8-pointer."
After completing the roll, he continued,
"And this is a 16-pointer.
After completing the second roll, he said,
"Sorry, that was a little sloppy. I'm not used to a plane where I'm fighting prop torque like this. Flying jets spoils a man."
After a beat, he shouted,
"Hands on stick!"
She obliged. He then declared,
"It's your aircraft,"
and dropped his hands. She was quizzical.
"What? That's all you show me?"
As she resumed control, he explained,
"Look, Blanca, I didn't come up here to show off my fighter jack stuff. I came to see you do your thing."
"Ah, and what do you think?"
"I think you're beautiful, and I think that your flying is just as beautiful.
Muy bella."
Blanca beamed and deftly banked to dive toward Lake Johor, visible in the distance. In the dive, their ground speed got above 160. He truly was impressed by her flying ability. He recognized that she was a natural for stick and rudder, as well as situational awareness. The thing that impressed him the most was her gracefulness in both right and left-hand turns. Most pilots were good at only one or the other, depending on their handedness. He commented to her on this, and she explained,
"Me papa, he's the tennis guy. Since I was a little girl, he insists that I learn everything ambidextrous. No, ambidextrously, even with the holding of a fork."
"La tenedor," Doyle reminded himself aloud from a recent lesson.
"El tenedor,"
she corrected.
"Sorry, I always get my masculines and feminines mixed up."
She turned to give him another smile.
"I think you are very masculine, Ian."
With the aerobatic maneuvering over, they both loosened their harnesses. Back in level flight and approaching the lago, Blanca again pushed the stick forward to swoop down low over the water. The plane scared up a huge flock of ducks. Marveling at the size of the flock of multicolored brown and black birds, Ian asked,
"What are those?"
"Here, we call them suriri piqui rojo. In English, they are called, I think, the black-bellied whistling duck."
They flew well above the flock, safe from any bird strikes. Blanca repeatedly banked the plane to get a better view. Then, after circling back, she pulled the throttle out, transitioning to slow flight to orbit the enormous flock. It looked like a veritable cloud of ducks. Ian snapped pictures with his camera. She then advanced the throttle to its mid-range and flew away from the lake back toward Tegucigalpa. Ian felt ecstatic.
"Wow! That was an incredible sight, Blanca!"
Ian reached over to place his hand on Blanca's shoulder. He realized that it was the second time he had ever touched her. He asked,
"Will you marry me?"
She punched the throttle to the firewall, and the acceleration threw Ian back against his seat. She looked
straight ahead, and then glanced down at the instruments. At first Ian thought that he had angered her. Then she turned and smiled.
"Of course I will marry you, Ian. But I gotta land this plane first."
Chapter 25, A Tight Spot. Anyone who clings to the historically untrue and thoroughly immoral doctrine that violence never solves anything, I would advise to conjure up the ghosts of Napoleon Bonaparte and of the Duke of Wellington and let them debate it. The ghost of Hitler could referee, and the jury might well be the dodo, the great auk, and the passenger pigeon. Violence, naked force, has settled more issues in history than has any other factor, and the contrary opinion is wishful thinking at its worst. Breeds that forget this basic truth have always paid for it with their lives and freedoms. Robert A. Heinlein, Starship Troopers. In the first week of July, several of the men from the compound, including Alex, Ian, and Dr. K, were part of a firewood-cutting expedition to the nearby Prescott National Forest. Traveling in a four-pickup convoy, they went beyond the ponderosa pines at the lower elevations to cut Douglas fir trees, mostly along the road that led to the Mingus Mountain campground. Three exhausting day-long trips each took 12 hours at three-day intervals. On the third day of the woodcutting enterprise, Blanca was on guard duty. She was startled to hear the sound of breaking glass downstairs. She left the ringer engaged for 30 seconds continuously, followed by three short rings. This signal told everyone that the compound was being attacked by infiltrators. Blanca thought that it would be safest to get back in the hot tub pillbox. She poked the muzzle of her M16 out of the hot tub, rotated the gun safety to semi, and held still. She sighted the gun on the bedroom door, looking through the screen door that divided the bedroom from the deck. The man who walked into the bedroom was armed with a carbine that looked a lot like Alex's Mini 14, except that it was shiny, perhaps stainless steel or chrome-plated, and it had a folding stock. The bullet hit him square in the chest. He went down, screaming and spurting blood. He didn't stop screaming and gasping for nearly a minute, and twitched for nearly another full minute after that. Blanca was horrified by what she had done. She had never imagined so much blood could come out of someone, and since she had never hunted, she was unprepared to see the man thrashing. Despite the fact that she had pushed her rifle's muzzle out beyond the lip of the hot tub, her ears were ringing. Just as she was wondering what to do next, she heard several shots coming from the far side of the compound and some indistinct shouts. Then there were two more shots. They sounded different. She surmised that these were pistol shots. An hour later, Blanca heard the full story. A group of five men and one woman, all armed, had attempted to sneak into the compound in broad daylight, assuming that they'd find the four families with their guard down. The end result was that the compound had more compost for their garden and more guns for their arsenal. Blanca inherited the Mini 14 from the man who she'd shot from the deck. Alex was impressed with the gun, explaining that it was a scarce GB model, like those sold to police departments and prison systems. Unlike a standard Mini 14, this gun had a factory flash hider and a factory side-folding stock. It was also made of stainless steel, rendering it less vulnerable to the elements. Alex declared it a keeper. He gave Blanca six original factory magazines for the gun and a pair of M16 triple magazine pouches to carry them in. Chapter 26, A Fair Share. A pistol defends your property and your person from unanticipated and barely anticipated threats from thieves and robbers. With it, you can control your immediate environment. A rifle defends your freedom from oppressors and tyrants. With it, you can enforce your will. Gabe Suarez. Hancomer, Texas. December, the first year. After La Fuerza had cleaned out everything of use from the stores in Anahuac, they moved north. Their next target was the small town of Hancomer. It was so small that they were able to clean it out house to house. Once that process started, many of the town's 500 residents fled, most of them on foot. It was in Hancomer that Garcia found Rodrigo Cruz. Garcia was about ready to order him killed, along with the others, when Cruz shouted, "Wait! You need me, man!" "What do I need you, pendejo?" Garcia questioned. Pointing to the big M2 machine gun on a pintle mount atop a V-100, he said, "I seen your guys fiddling with that Browning 50. They could only get it to fire single shot. The timing screwed up. I can fix that. I was an armorer in the Marines. I know how to set headspace and timing, all that stuff. I got a whole set of machine gun manuals and some tools in my house." Ignacio snorted. "Show me, and maybe I'll let you live." After Hancomer, La Fuerza continued brazenly hitting small towns in East Texas. They first swung in a large arc north and then westward. They skipped Dayton, but then hit Hardin and Moss Hill. In Moss Hill, Garcia found a full-length mink coat for his wife, who had chronically complained of being cold. That immediately became a status symbol for all the wives and girlfriends of the gang members. They all wanted a full-length fur coat, and eventually they got them. Mostly mink, but some raccoon and foxskin. They wore them so often that the coats became a trademark of La Fuerza. After losing one of their pickups in a spectacular fire, Garcia ordered that they replace their fleet of unarmored vehicles with diesel engine equivalents as quickly as they could find them. They eventually standardized with pickups and vans with Ford Powerstroke 6-liter diesel engines. They systematically stole everyone that they came across, gradually re-equipping their small army. Their raiding methodology was simple. Send one pickup ahead with a husband, wife, and 2 or 3 kids to scout, acting like innocent refugees. They would use a CB to relay the situation. Then the entire convoy would be timed to arrive at dawn. Any resistance was crushed. They took what they wanted. Fuel, vehicles, tires, food, batteries, cutting torches, guns, ammunition, liquor, drugs, gold, and jewelry. Then they left. In some of the smallest towns where they met any shooting opposition, they killed everyone that they could find. They stayed in those towns longer and stripped them to the bone. But typically, they would just barge into a town, loot and scoot. They very soon learned that it wasn't safe to stay in a large town overnight after looting, so they spent most of their nights camped at parks, airports, and wildlife refuges, wherever they could find plentiful water. Their modus operandi was to hit a town, spend the day looting, and then travel at least 25 miles before dark to camp. It was after losing 2 more vehicles in a gun battle in Livingston that Garcia acquired his first 2 civilian armored trucks. One of his scouts found these parked in a lot on the east side of College Station, Texas. They had been owned by an armored car company that specialized in servicing ATM machines. Getting the keys only took a few minutes of torture. Eventually, they gathered more and more armored trucks and vans as they went, mainly from the Rochester and Garda armored car agencies. Garcia and his family soon traveled exclusively in one of the armored car company trucks. It was a 2.5-ton, built on a 1998 Ford F-800 chassis with a 5.9 Cummins diesel engine. Because of its box-like shape, Ignacio jokingly called it his bread truck. La Fuerza accumulated a large collection of young armed men in its wake. Wherever he went, Garcia recruited those he met who were smart, skilled, and ruthless. As it turned out, most of them were paroled convicts, recently escaped convicts, and members of the MS-13 gang, which had been a natural gathering place for hardened criminals. Ignacio wanted to build up La Fuerza rapidly, so that he could have at least 100 vehicles rolling into a town all at once. Very few would defy that show of force, at least not for long. Their casualties when raiding small towns were fairly light. They made a point of never hitting any town with a population more than 2,000. To Garcia's surprise, most of their losses came when they were camped at night. Typically, in the dead of the night, a shot or two would ring out, and one of their sentries would go down, often shot in the back from outside their perimeter. Then the camp would be in an uproar, and patrols would be sent out with night vision goggles, but they'd usually find nothing. Sometimes, they'd find just an accidentally dropped magazine or a piece of fired brass. Tony would say matter-of-factly, "Militia bastards." They had so many tires shot out, usually when they'd first arrive in a town, that they eventually settled on carrying 6 spares mounted on rims on the roof of every vehicle. Eventually, it was the loss of tires that forced them to abandon the Saracen APCs one after the other as they went along. The Saracens used special run-flat tires with a hard rubber inner rim. This size tire was not one stocked by American truck tire dealers. According to files that his wife had saved on her laptop, there was a dealer on the East Coast that catered to MVPA members who had a pile of tires and wheels for Saracens. But to Garcia, those might just as well be on the moon. Once the outer tire was punctured by gunfire, it shredded and came off within 200 miles. Then the APC's top speed dropped to under 25 miles per hour, and they became more difficult to steer. La Fuerza's convoys needed to travel at least 40 miles an hour. In contrast, they were able to keep the Caddy Gage V-100s on the road because they used fairly standard tires that were found on some front-end loaders. One of the V-100s did have its rear transaxle fail, but they were able to replace it with one salvaged from a ubiquitous M-35 deuce-and-a-half Army transport truck. Some of La Fuerza's favorite targets were firehouses, for two reasons. First, their kitchens often had well-stocked pantries with large containers of staple foods like pasta, rice, and beans. Secondly, and more importantly, they almost always had their selection of tools intact. These included Halligan pry bars, large traditional crowbars, fire axes, and gas engine-powered automated prying jaws of life, or, as Ignacio called them, jaws of loot. All of these tools proved invaluable to the gang when they needed to break into a building or a home gun vault. The Halligans were particularly useful in prying doors away from their door frames. They found that once door frames were separated, the doors could be easily just kicked open. In West Texas, La Fuerza crossed paths with a gang that was affiliated with MS-13. Calling themselves Los Lobos, the Wolves, the gang was headed by Adolfo Contares. This gang numbered 120, and, like La Fuerza, they had been skipping from town to town. They were less sophisticated than La Fuerza, but they were just as ruthless. Rather than fighting them or competing with them, Ignacio decided to assimilate Los Lobos. He called for a meeting with their leader and proposed that they work together to loot Floydada, Texas. This was agreeable, since the town was too large for either gang to take independently. After they had taken Floydada, Ignacio called for a celebratory feast and rape party. The gangs met at the Floydada Inn for the party. Ignacio made arrangements in advance to have one of his men poison the drinks of Contares, his girlfriend, and his second in command. He did this late in the evening, after everyone was well-liquored and high on various drugs. The next morning, Garcia blamed the three deaths on drug overdoses. He then declared, "We are heading to New Mexico. Anyone from Los Lobos is welcome to join us, but you will be under my command." Everyone joined. Garcia's now greatly enlarged gang cut a swath through southern New Mexico and southern Arizona. As the gang continued to grow, they could hit towns as large as 20,000 people with relative impunity. 20 miles off the coast of Guinea-Bissau, December, the first year. The Douro Brabis was making steady progress down the coast of Guinea-Bissau. The plan was to work their way far enough south, following the Canary Current on the old clipper route, with the goal of catching the northeast trade winds to sail west across the Atlantic. Carsten Sims warned, "We must stay out of the South Atlantic High. We mustn't get out in the doldrums. On paper, a plant course looks like a longer route, but in actuality, it is the fastest and safest route to Central America. The alternative is sailing the North Atlantic, but we daren't do that in winter." During Taft's afternoon watch, Andy was awoken by a shout.
"Could be trouble! Speedboat! Coming up from behind!"
Andy rolled out of the sail locker and trotted down the length of the cabin, blinking in the sudden transition to daylight. He could see that Taft's family and Donna Sims were seated at the salon table, wide-eyed. The twins were both still holding hands of playing cards. Andy popped out the hatch to the aft deck and was handed a pair of binoculars by Taft. He focused on the boat, which was 400 yards astern, and gaining quickly. The Douro Brabis was under full sail one quarter into the wind. Lane reckoned that even if they turned for full wind, they'd still be outrun by the speedboat.
"Break out the air softs," Andy ordered.
Sims complied, pulling the two fake submachine guns from a locker beneath one of the forward cabin V-berths. The seat cushions were hastily tossed aside, and the locker lid was swung open. No one was on the low forward deck of the speedboat, but there were a couple of heads that could be seen through the windshield. Lane set down the binoculars and unholstered his pistol. Donna took the wheel, while Karsten, Andy, and Alan positioned themselves, kneeling on the deck with their elbows on the aft bench and their guns held below the stern rail, making a show of force, just as they had practiced. Karsten shouted to his wife,
"Hold that course!"
When the boat was within 60 yards, two men with AKMs popped up from prone positions on the foredeck seats and pointed their guns toward the Douro Brabis. But before they could shoot, Andy took three well-aimed shots. A bullet struck one of the gunmen in the chest, and he collapsed, dropping out of sight. Simultaneously, the other gunman let loose a wild burst of full-auto fire, aimed much too high to be effective. Andy fired four more times, with one bullet hitting the man in the neck. He, too, dropped out of sight. Now just 15 yards astern, the speedboat veered off sharply, and Andy rapidly emptied his pistol into the exposed side of the boat, concentrating his fire on the cockpit and just forward of it. Lane did a quick reload, tossed his empty 20-round magazine through the hatch and shouted,
"Refill that, Jules!"
The speedboat made a run for the coast, with no sign of turning back toward them. Alan Taft looked pale. He stuttered,
Did you see the blood spraying up from those men? The men on the front deck?"
Lane nodded gravely, but then he turned and said calmly to Angie,
"You can go back to your card game now."
After that incident, Sims changed their course to take them farther offshore. They found seven bullet holes in the canvas near the top of the mainsail. Patching the holes took less than an hour. The trip across the Atlantic was surprisingly uneventful. With favorable winds and currents, they averaged 140 miles per day for most of the journey. The cramped quarters on the Douro Brabis led to a few arguments, But overall, everyone got along fairly well. Simone Taft never had much harmony with Andy. She had been born in Paris, but raised in London. She had a universally condescending attitude, even toward her husband. One day, in the midst of a disagreement about where and when hand-washed clothes should be hung up to dry, Simone got belligerent with Lane. She chided,
"I don't like you, Andis, and I don't like guns. If it weren't for your pistol, you'd still be in England."
"Correction. If it weren't for my pistol, we'd all be shark food right now. Ma'am, you need to get used to how the real world operates."
She shut up after that. Chapter 27. Hunkered Down. Every action is seen to fall into one of three main categories: guarding, hitting, or moving. Here, then, are the elements of combat, whether in war or pugilism. B. H. Liddell Hart, Strategy, 1929. Bloomfield, New Mexico, January, the second year. The economy of the Four Corners was in shambles, with the power miraculously still on, but the value of the dollar destroyed. The few merchants left in business soon reverted to simple barter or taking pre-1965 mint date silver coinage for payment. The most commonly accepted currencies were silver dimes, silver quarters, 22 long rifle rimfire cartridges, cigarettes, and boxes of new mason jar lids. All of the local banks and credit unions soon closed, but one community bank eventually reopened as a warehouse bank, primarily for the use of its vault space by local merchants who needed a safe place to store their silver coinage. Eventually, they bought another disused bank building as a second branch, just for the use of their vault space. Word quickly spread that there was still gasoline available for sale, and the power was still on in Bloomfield and Farmington. Customers drove from as far away as Moab, Utah, Durango, Colorado, Tuba City, Arizona, and Window Rock, New Mexico. Many of them drove pee cups that were crammed full with enough gas cans to give a fire marshal a heart attack. The byword was, "Come with silver coin or don't come at all." The Bloomfield refinery started to do a land office retail business, but Elroy wanted to work out wholesale deals with gas stations as soon as possible. The steady flow of retail customers coming through the gate represented a security risk. Soon after working the deal with Alan Archer, Martin set up a similar gas-on-credit arrangement with Antonio Jaquez, the owner of a gas station in Bloomfield. Jaquez, who came from one of the early pioneer families in the region, reopened his gas station. He did a brisk business and gradually built quite a pile of silver coins. Muddy Pond, Tennessee, November the first year. It was a great place to ride out the crunch. Ben Fielding believed that he had landed in Muddy Pond, Tennessee, providentially. 10 years before the economy fell apart, Ben was an associate attorney in a Nashville law firm. He had been hired to defend a Mennonite man who had been charged in a wrongful death lawsuit filed by the family of a tourist killed in a fall from a hay wagon. When he traveled to Overton County to see the scene of the accident and interview the defendant, Ben fell in love with the area. There, he met two other Messianic Jewish families like his own, and he developed an affinity for the dozens of Mennonites who would become his neighbors. Although he had differences with them on some points of Christian doctrine and their hyper-pacifism, he admired their hard work and clean living. When he returned home, he described the village to his wife, Rebecca, and they committed the issue to prayer. As Jewish believers in Jesus, they had an active prayer life and believed in heeding God's guidance in how, when, and where they should live. Shortly after first seeing Overton County, and after much prayer, Ben felt led to shift to a body of law that would enable him to work from home. He transitioned to wills, trusts, and estates law. A year later, he was able to quit the firm and go into practice for himself, working from home. His law practice was ideal for this. His clientele grew by word of mouth, and eventually he had clients from all over the nation. 8 years before the crunch, he bought a 40-acre farm near Muddy Pond and soon moved Rebecca and their 5 children there. Muddy Pond was a 90-mile drive east of Nashville and an 80-mile drive west of Knoxville. The town, located on the upper Cumberland Plateau, was several turns off of any major road, so only local traffic passed through. Aside from a few bed-and-breakfast yuppie tourists who sought out plain people quaintness, few Tennesseans had ever heard of Muddy Pond. The village had a general store and just one summer tourist attraction, a horse-powered sorghum press. Without planning it, or, as Ben said, by Hashem's providence, the Fieldings were in the right place at the right time when the crunch occurred. His 1960s Mennonite-built farmhouse had a good well that produced 22 gallons per minute. A water tower above it was kept filled by a very reliable Dempster windmill. The house lights were propane, and he heated the house with wood and coal. Their only modern conveniences, necessitated by Ben's law practice, were 2 phone lines and a wind-powered alternative energy system with a 2.4-kilowatt Skystream windmill and 6 sharp solar photovoltaic panels. The Fielding family did most of their cooking with a propane range. There was also a propane engine backup generator for the battery bank, but they only rarely had to run it. Right after they had purchased the farm, Ben was shocked with an estimate of $18,500 to have the Cookeville Electric Department extend the power lines to his farm. After doing some pricing, he concluded that it would be less expensive to simply make his own power. He hired Lightwave Solar Electric in Nashville to install the PV panels and Ready-Made Resources in Tellico Plains, Tennessee, to install the Skystream wind generator. As the crunch set in, Ben assessed his situation. He concluded that his family's greatest need would be more propane storage, so he replaced their existing 250-gallon leased tank with an 1,800-gallon tank that he purchased. He also ordered an extra 2 tons of coal. This exceeded the capacity of their basement coal bin, so they stored the rest in the pallet boxes in the barn. There was still a bit of gasoline available, for $18.99 per gallon, but no cans for sale. Ben filled the tanks on all of his vehicles, including his ATV, and his 4 5-gallon gas cans, but that still left him feeling woefully short of gasoline for an extended emergency. By the time that Rebecca suggested filling some steel milk cans with gasoline, all of the gas stations had closed. Ben did his best to stock up on ammunition for his rifle and pistol, but he found very little available. Altogether, he had less than 700 rounds. But by scouring the Internet, he did manage to find some exorbitantly priced spare magazines for his pistol, an HK USP Compact 45, and his rifle, a Galil ARM 308. After hearing the news about the riots spreading all over America's cities, Ben gathered his family for an evening of devotional study. His wife and children gathered on the 2 living room couches. That night, he had selected Proverbs 1:24-33 for their reading. He thought it was particularly fitting, given the news headlines. He read aloud, "Because I have called, and ye refuse, I have stretched out my hand, and no man regarded. But ye have set at naught all my counsel, and would none of my reproof. I also will laugh at your calamity,
I will mock when your fear cometh. When your fear cometh as desolation, and your destruction cometh as a whirlwind, when distress and anguish cometh upon you, then shall they call upon me, but I will not answer. They shall seek me early, but they shall not find me. For that they hated knowledge, and did not choose the fear of the Lord, they would none of my counsel, they despised all my reproof. Therefore shall they eat of the fruit of their own way, and be filled with their own devices. For the turning away of the simple shall slay them, and the prosperity of fools shall destroy them. But whoso hearkeneth unto me shall dwell safely, and shall be quiet from fear of evil. Chapter 28. Terminal Ballistics. There exists a law, not written down anywhere, but inborn in our hearts, a law which comes to us not by training or custom or reading, a law which has come to us not from theory but from practice, not by instruction but by natural intuition. I refer to the law which lays down that if our lives are endangered by plots or violence or armed robbers or enemies, any and every method of protecting ourselves is morally right. Marcus Tullius Cicero, 106 to 43 B.C. South of Farmington, New Mexico, April, the second year. In the April of the year after the crunch began, Lars was summoned to the Nappy headquarters, 7 miles south of Farmington, for some consulting work. He was told that an isolated Nappy grain elevator had been taken over by an armed gang. One of the employees had been shot during the takeover and had died a day later. Lars drove to meet the Nappy president at the company headquarters. He was a Navajo in his 60s. With him in the conference room were a group of 9 younger men, all tribal members. Lars queried, "How many men were there?" One of the employees raised his hand. "Hey, there was a bunch, maybe 10 of them. They're Mexicans. They drove up in 3 pickups and a minivan. There was just 3 of us there, and only 2 of us had guns. They shot Alvin first thing, so we ran. We had to carry Alvin part of the way to our pickups." One of the men asked Lane anxiously, "So, what do we do? Are we going to rush them?" Lars shook his head. "No, no, no. Why risk taking any more casualties? Tell me, is there any really pressing need for any of that grain in the next few weeks?" The Nappy president answered, "No, not really. We also got a tribal storehouse in town. It's got enough, I suppose, even for the rest of the winter." "So we wait them out and engage them on our own terms. What is the water situation at the elevator?"
"A cistern above ground. I think it's 500 gallons. We have to haul in the water for that. There's a flush toilet in the building that we don't use much because it wastes water. Instead, we use a drop toilet about 75 yards out back behind some gamble oaks. But we don't dare tell the health department about it. No permit. And it sure don't meet no code."
"Is the cistern a metal tank or masonry brick?"
"Neither. It's one of the new blue poly ones."
"No other source of water there?"
"Nope. Not for miles."
Lane laughed and asked, "Who here is a good shot with a deer rifle?" Several men raised their hands. Lars said, "I've got a silver dollar for whoever can punch a hole in the side of that tank within 3 inches of the bottom." The men laughed uproariously, realizing that they could simply force the bandits out by depriving them of water. Lars laid out the plan. "We'll set up 2-man teams with scoped rifles in shallow foxhole positions, 350 yards out.
We'll use three teams with full coverage of the elevator buildings. We'll make sure that they each have night vision scopes or monoculars. One of the men protested.
350 yards? That's an awful long way to shoot.